Okay, well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first Economy and Society guest lecture held here at the LSE with our very distinguished speaker here today, Professor Ian Hacking. Before the talk, let me just say a few words, first of all, about Economy and Society and then about Professor Hacking. Economy and Society is now 31 years old. It is the UK's leading interdisciplinary social science journal and tries to publish work which is both original conceptually and original empirically. For the last few months, it's been based here in the Department of Sociology at the London School of Economics, although that's not its permanent home. It's rather peripatetic with its editor. I currently happen to be its editor. We've inaugurated a number of things to extend the public outreach of the journal, including seminar series, which you'll see details of in the journal itself, and this series of annual guest lectures. And there could be no better inaugurator of our annual series of guest lectures than Professor Ian Hacking. Partly, of course, because Ian is a member of the editorial advisory board of the journal and has written and published in the journal, but more significantly because of the nature of his work and its originality. There's a lot of work published, as anyone who goes into a bookstore knows, and the problems of choice overwhelm most of us, or certainly overwhelm me, but when a new book by Ian Hacking is published, I rush out and even shell out for it in hardback. And recently we've been fortunate to have quite a number of those books, from Rewriting the Soul, a fantastic book on multiple personality disorder and the sciences of memory in 1995, The Social Construction of What, a very provocative critique of the move to social constructionism in the social sciences, published in 1999, and Historical Ontology, published in 2002. Of course, that's only one part of Professor Hacking's work, because there's a whole other stream of his work, which is very scholarly work in the area of statistics itself, starting from his early background, having been first of all educated in mathematics and philosophy, mathematics and physics, and then in moral sciences. And this work, too, has had a major impact. I mean, not only providing a radical new way of understanding the history of statistics, but also locating statistics firmly within the social sciences. The Taming of Chance, if anybody in this audience has not read The Taming of Chance, I would recommend you rush out and buy it from Waterstones if it's still open after the lecture. And of course, what seems to me to be a seminal contribution to our understanding of the nature of science, contemporary sciences, that is Representing and Intervening, which seemed to me in one very short book, which I believe were first year lectures, to place the philosophy of science and the social studies of science on a radically new basis. Anyhow, you haven't come to hear me, you've come to hear Ian Hacking. So without more ado, I'd like to introduce Professor Ian Hacking, who is a professor in the University of Toronto and also professor holds a chair in the Collège de France. And we're very honored to have him here tonight. And he's going to talk on, between Michel Foucault and Irving Goffman, the theme of making up people.
Thank you very much, Nick. This is indeed a talk for Economy and Society because it was motivated by a truly excellent review essay that Michael Lynch published in Economy and Society under the title The Contingencies of Social Construction, published in May 2001. It was a review of two books of mine, The Social Construction of What and Mad Travelers, Reflections on the Reality of Transient Mental Illnesses. The former book is an ephemeral book. It addresses a debate about social construction which was current 4 or 5 years ago and which I hope is drawing to a close. The latter book, Mad Travelers, which Nick did not mention in his generous account, but which is now available in paperback, I gave it as lectures at the University of Virginia, which is a university which still remembers the gentlemanly character of a certain American past. So it doesn't actually sell its books. So you couldn't buy it, although it got rave reviews in all those fancy journals, but it's now available as a paperback from Harvard University Press, who bought the paperback rights. It's called Mad Travelers, Reflections on the Reality of Transient Mental Illnesses, and Michael Lynch in this book reviews that, I thought highly intelligently, with the social construction of what. Social construction of what is ephemeral, but I think the Mad Travelers is of interest, not just because it has a lot of, it's a fascinating story about a certain history, but because what I call transient mental illnesses are always with us. I mean by that certain ways to be mad, or more politely, troubled or disturbed, that occur only at a time and at a place. Anorexia is a really serious trouble, mostly of young women, which occurs only at certain times. The word anorexia is old, but the current sort of epidemic of anorexia is located in a particular space and time. The most intense occurrence of anorexia is in Argentina. Perfect example of the way in which a transient mental illness finds its home in a place. Certain ways to be mad or to be troubled, which can, for instance, in the case of anorexia, be life-threatening, which occur only at a time and a place. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which Nick writes about under the heading of Ritalin, the drug that treats it, and which I think about in terms of how it itself is a disorder which I am inclined to call transient, occurring at certain places and at certain times. In the case of mad travelers, it's an epidemic of men with sudden, inexplicable impulses to take to the high road, largely unaware of what they are doing, why they are traveling, or who they are. They click out of it at some stage. This is a disorder which began in Bordeaux and which continued for some 20 years or so, was a major subject of psychiatric analysis for those 20 years and has now disappeared. Hence my liking of the word transient, because things come and they go. Of the two books which were reviewed by Mike Lynch, only one chapter of The Social Construction of What, the third, intersects with this type of investigation. But it's the only one that really interests me. Now, this work on how classification relates to people and how people relate to how they are classified. Of course, we have other words, diagnosed and so forth, but just say classified, is one of the topics that I have been thinking about for, as it turns out, exactly 20 years. In 1983, I gave a talk called Making Up People, which was programmatic and is a program one of the programs I still find myself involved with. How do ways to classify people open up or close down possibilities for human action? How do classifications of people affect the people classified? How do we change in virtue of the way in which we are classified? How do ways in which we change have a sort of feedback or circular or looping effect on the people who are classified or on the systems of classifications themselves? Somewhat after that talk 20 years ago, I went on to talk about the looping effects, the feedback between classifications and the people classified. Mad Travelers, and my book on multiple personality, Rewriting the Soul, were, among other things, detailed studies of how classifications and people classified have interacted. And I would like them to be seen in that way. They are, I hope, intrinsically interesting. Mad Travelers has an amazing story of a mad traveler. But it's an intended as a perhaps ideal type of the way in which classifications and people interact. I named this approach to philosophy with a fancy name, dynamic nominalism. The traditional nominalist is supposed to say that stars or algae or justice, that's Plato, have no thing in common except our names for them. The word star, the word algae, the word justice. I don't know if there have ever been paradoxical nominalists that strong. My dynamic nominalism, directed at new classifications of people, suggests that sometimes there was not a kind of person who came increasingly to be recognized and to which a name was given, but rather a kind of person came into being at the same time as the name of that kind of person, at the same time as that name was being invented. In some cases, our classifications and the people who are classed conspire to emerge sort of hand in hand, each egging each other on. Curiously, one could put the emphasis differently. One could equally call this not dynamic nominalism, but dialectical realism. Nominalism and realism are commonly put off as opposites. A dialectic between real classes being formed and the description of their members. In any event, this is not the arid, logical nominalism that says that naming creates classes. It's dynamic and dialectical. Naming has real effects on the people who are classified. They change. And the people have real effects on how they are classified. Notice my emphasis on new classifications, maybe with the same words, but new ways in which they are classified. In the 1980s, I did a lot of work on the development of the idea of child abuse, precisely because it was rapidly changing before our eyes. I was looking for an example of a type of classification of human beings, together with all the theory that goes around it, and I had tea with a very distinguished senior feminist sociologist, Dorothy Smith, And I said, Dorothy, what would be a really good example of a way of classifying people or their actions which is changing right before our eyes? Because I'm interested in how possibilities change. And she said, looking down into her tea, you might think about child abuse. I don't think she was serious. I don't think she really expected me to spend the next 3 years of my life thinking about child abuse, which is not a very happy topic to think about, not for the obvious reasons, but because you meet an awful lot of very disagreeable people, not just those who are abusing or those who are abused, but also the theoreticians of the subject. But it set me going precisely because it's an example of what I would like to discuss under the whole heading of child abuse. I went on to talk about looping effects, feedback between classifications, people classified. Michael Lynch asked an important question. When I am doing all this, he asked, is Ian Hacking rewriting the loop? I think I have the actual wonderful sentence that he wrote, but it somehow got lost. Here it is. Sociologists who read Hacking may appreciate his substantive research, but wonder if he is not reinventing the wheel, or rather, they may wonder if he is not reinventing the loop. And then he went on to suggest that the man, the scholar, scientist, sociologist who invented the loop and whom I did not discuss was Irving Goffman. And he, Michael Lynch, very politely said that although I was doing something different, there were important overlaps. And I think he was absolutely right. I want to say a certain amount about Goffman and the general structure for thinking about my kind of question. But before proceeding to produce what looks like something very general, very abstract, very philosophical, I want to repeat a disclaimer or caution that I issued 20 years ago in 1983. I don't believe there is a general story to be told about making up people. Each category by which we are sorted and by which we sort ourselves has its own history. If you want to try for a framework in which to describe such events of transformation, one might think of forces working in two directions. From above come classifications and naming. From below comes the actions of people. And as a foreshadowing, I can say, of course, that the naming from above, although Foucault always said it was circular, is what Foucault taught me about. And what comes from below, the autonomous behavior of people who are labeled and who are also a reality, is something that one can learn about from Goffman. I want to repeat that emphasis. Just because what I call dynamic nominalism invites us to examine the intricacies of real life, it has no intention of producing a general philosophical structure, system, or theory. I ended my first stab at this topic 20 years ago with the words, I see no, this is literally the last sentence, I see no reason to suppose that we shall ever tell two identical stories of two different instances of making up people, which is not to say that the concept of making up people is not of great general importance. I remain firm in that conviction and attitude which is one reason I have done all those detailed stories in the past 20 years. There is, nevertheless, a question that can sensibly be asked. I talk about making up people. What do I think a person is? I believe my own attitude was perhaps unwittingly formed in part by one of the heroic episodes in philosophy. A heroic episode, in my language, is one which tries to paint a picture of the whole of human nature and its place in nature. One such episode was post-war French existentialism, stemming from being a nothingness, which Sartre finished and even presented in 1943. Existentialism is paradoxical because it offered a vision, highly intellectual, but nevertheless a vision, of the whole of human nature, of what it is to be a person, while denying that humans have a nature at all. The nature of a human being is to have no intrinsic nature, but to live one's life constantly choosing who one is and taking responsibility for the person one chooses to be. The most banal expression of existentialism was existence precedes essence. Those words have been used by serious thinkers with the highest level of rigor. But I don't forget that many years ago, adolescents, of whom I was one, used to exclaim that sort of thing without having much idea of what it might mean. It was code for the idea that one was young and rebellious, and that nothing was as fixed as it seemed, that sexual conventions in particular could be thwarted by free acts of choice. Nevertheless, it was part of being an ill-adapted teenager that one did read, aside from novels, the work of people who were said to be existentialist philosophers. Some of them seemed very deep and quite hard to understand. Kierkegaard comes to mind. Others were much more user-friendly, and Sartre was tops. I confess it is impossible for me to reread Sartre without being infused once again with kind of rosy adolescent sloppiness. Hence, in these, I don't profess scholarship, just a certain banal sense of what one part of existentialism was all about, which almost completely ignores two of the most important aspects of post-war French existentialism, the strong vein of phenomenology that Sartre and others imported from Husserl, and the historical connection between existentialism and very strong political commitment. Existence precedes essence. What that means to me is that who you are is determined by your own actions and choices. Yes, you have an essence, a character. You are a certain kind of person. Most of the time, you act in definite and predictable ways. True, even if you are kind of a miserable candidate for living the life of a whole human being. It's even true of a person who fits the title of Robert Musil's wonderful book, The Man Without Qualities. Deeply, what would it be to be a bit, this is Eigenschaft, it's to be a man, because essences have properties, it's to be a man, it's partly to be a man without an essence. But even then, your character, your consistent and self-revealing patterns of behavior, because the mockery of Musil's novel, is how a man without qualities is absolutely regular in his behavior. He's the ultimate person who doesn't choose and yet whose choices are all consistent. They're not something you're born with. You acquired them as you made choices of what to do and sometimes what to be and who to be. That's not to say that in any ordinary sense you are unconstrained or were free of constraint when you made the choices that led to your being you. There are all sorts of blind, meaningless constraints on the activities of each of us. And endless, blind, meaningless things that have happened to each of us and which shut down some possibilities and which open up others in completely unexpected ways. Do think about that. Think about the things that have happened to you which have opened up possibilities, but also the overall burden of this talk is think about how ways in which to be a person have often come into being even in your lifetime. You chose what to do under whatever circumstances you found yourself in, and those choices are what formed you and which continue to form you. Responsibility was the Sartrean message, is taking responsibility for that being that you become as a consequence of choosing. And it's by no means simply a question of choosing what to do, but also of choosing who to associate with. Essences, as Pascal taught us when he wrote about his famous wager, which I am fascinated by, of whether or not to act as if you believe in God. Essences are infectious. To some extent, you catch how to be a person from those you have chosen to make your friends and fellows. Who you are now, was the Sartrean message, is your responsibility, even if some of the things which you are because of who you chose your friends, you chose your friends. And if you don't like who you are, you may well think it's your fault that that is who you are. And it's true for all of us at age 20 or at age 80, although usually the field of choices is greater at the younger age and the essence is less solidly entrenched. Although, and I will call we adolescents, that's me, didn't notice it at the time, this picture of the human condition was far less radical than it sounded. The idea that you make who you are and are responsible for who you are is as deep a tradition in Western philosophy as could be, not only with romantic figures such as Pascal, it's at the heart of all those philosophies that encourage spiritual exercises for forming the satisfying self. A whole gamut of ancient philosophers comes to mind, Stoics, Epicureans, and the like. It was also the teaching of those haughty individuals whom we tend to imagine as very prim and proper, namely Aristotle and Kant. I would not say that the idea of autonomy is a human universal, or even that it has always been present throughout all of the Western history of civilization, but it is surprisingly endemic to our religions and to our view of life. The highest aspirations take responsibility not only for what you do, but also for what you make of yourself, how you make yourself. There is no need to turn to make this story simplistic or to deny evident facts. We're born with a lot of essential characteristics we can't change. Most of us can change how fat or thin, how trim or flabby our bodies may be, but a great many physical characteristics appear to be fixed at the moment of conception, and we don't yet have the genetic technology to change much of that, even if Nick Rose is studying how people are about to change all those things. And even if it were desirable, we don't do it, and it will only be the privilege of a few people for as long as I'm alive. Neurologists and cognitive scientists teach us the same thing about the brain. Many of the possibilities available to us and many of the constraints imposed upon us were dealt us at birth. At most, we choose what we can do with what is there, and that's only the beginning. The chances of birth, of family, of war, of hunger, of social station, of the supports or oppression due to religion or caste, of wanton cruelty or high rates of unemployment. Once you start listing everything, there doesn't seem to be much room for choice after all, and choices for the lucky. Bernard Williams and Thomas Nagel have taught us much about moral luck, and that concept applies to those of us who have seldom been faced with truly hard choices. It also applies to the luck that we are able to hear and heed Aristotle or Kant or Sartre, and to reflect on the extent of our own freedom, not only to choose what to do, or the extent of what kind of person to be. Existence may precede essence for the lucky, but there is a vast dead weight of essence that presses down on most human beings. And that's precisely the object of the most optimistic theory of political economy in existence, that of Amartya Sen, whose thoroughly practical economic goals, such as more education for women, are aimed at increasing what we might call the pool of autonomy within a society, although he thinks there is a certain determinism there. The more educated the women, the more freedom everybody in society has. If Sen could be viewed as the great existential optimist, Freud is the great existential pessimist. Even when material conditions are as good as they are for, let's say, at least half of the population of present Europe, freedom is threatened once again by Sigmund Freud. What or who is the judge? Kant used to ask. Freud asked not who judges, but who chooses. Often it is that pitiless, invisible superego that judges you, even if it was not the you, but some less conscious part of yourself that chose. Supposed to say, know thyself in order that you can choose. What's the thyself? There are too many battling selves in which no one self can be conscious for there to be a self who is choosing and judging. In many ways, it was Freud who perverted and destroyed existentialism. Because, taken in one way, psychoanalysis called in question, for people brought up on the idea of the choosing self, the very idea of a self, of a subject who chooses. On rereading Sartre, one sees he was at enormous pains to examine all the kinds of constraints under which we rightly judge that our freedom is limited, and to insist that we have the opportunity to make choices there. The doctrine that existence precedes essence doesn't mean that a person, a human being, doesn't come with a pre-made character. The possibilities that are open to one's character and potentialities are formed during one's life, even if for many they become petrified at an early age. As Sartre well knew, at any place and at any time, only some possibilities even make sense. He also implied the next question, which is the one that has preoccupied me. How is the space of possible and actual action constrained, not just by physical and social barriers and opportunities, but also by the ways in which we conceptualize and realize who we are and what we may be? in this here and now. For every person, in every era, he emphasized, the world is a plenitude of possibilities. And to quote him, of course a contemporary of Duns Scotus is ignorant of the use of the automobile or the aeroplane, for the one who has no relation of any kind to these objects and the techniques that refer to them, there is a sort of absolute unthinkable and undecipherable nothingness. There is a nothing. Such a nothing can in no way limit the for itself that is choosing itself. It cannot be apprehended as a lack, no matter how we consider it. And he repeats, the feudal world offered to the vassal lord of Raymond the VI infinite possibilities of choice. We don't possess more. Yeah, but absolute, unthinkable, undecipherable nothingness. I think that's a beautiful way of describing possibilities which are not expressed in our way of thinking. How do we pass from absolute, unthinkable, and undecipherable nothingness to a possible way to be? We're not only what we are, but what we might have been. And a new kind of possibility means that the possibility for what we can become and what we might have been are transformed. Now, in this question of how possibilities come to act on us and how we discover new possibilities, I think I've learned a great deal. My whole work of a certain sort, including the Mad Travelers and all the rest of that stuff, has been profoundly influenced by Michel Foucault. And as Michael Lynch said, ought to be influenced by Irving Goffman. They are contemporaries. I will mention their dates of birth and death. Foucault, 1926-1984. Goffman, 1922-1982. Perfectly complementary. And they give curiously complementary answers to the question of how one should think of possibilities being made up and acting on us. Both began with the extreme case, what Goffman called the total institution, the prison, the mental hospital, the concentration camp, the monastery, the boarding school, the naval vessel. It's a curious accident of history or of ideas that in 1961, Goffman and Foucault, who had never heard of each other, both published extraordinary works on madness and its institutions. Asylums, in the case of Goffman, and Histoire de la Folie, in the case of Foucault. They were essentially the same age, Foucault 4 years younger than Goffman. Both produced accounts of institutions and madness in the same year. And each book set the stage for each author's brilliant future trajectory. Each body of work can be read in many words, many ways, many talks, many resemblances, but you can think of it as the philosophy of human nature after Sartre, because it's about how possibilities come into being, whereas Sartre was talking about how we make choices within some kinds of possibilities. Goffman analyzed, by a series of ideal types, the ways in which human roles are constituted in face-to-face interactions within an institutional setting, and how patterns of normality and deviance work on individual agents, and how the agents change these norms by a kind of feedback effect. Foucault's archaeologies establish the preconditions for and the mutations between successive institutional forms. His later genealogies are closer to how the historical settings work on people to form their potentialities, but never indicate how this happens in daily life. While Goffman does that in rich detail and gives no hint of how the surrounding structures themselves were constituted. Now here I don't want to attend to what has interested so many readers, especially of Foucault, namely so-called power effects. Goffman said, in our types of societies, total institutions are places of coercion intended to change people. They're both concerned with power effects, but I want instead to draw on the archaeological and the sociological approach to try to understand the ways in which the actual and possible lives of real individuals, you and me, are constituted. There are, of course, many, many ways to do this. Pierre Bourdieu made us attend to the ways in which patterns of behavior, including or maybe especially body language, become internalized, automatic, unconscious manifestations of who we are, so that even when we walk along the street, people know from the way in which we walk, not just the way in which we dress, of course we are both dressed in very appropriate ways, not just the ways in which we dress, but the ways in which we walk, the ways in which we talk, the ways in which we order a beer or a pression at a bar. Everything is part of our, what Bourdieu called, habitus. Now, I'm more concerned with issues that return us to Sartre. More concerned with issues in Foucault and Goffman that return us to Sartre, rather than down in this extraordinary development of the sociological world, which I mentioned for you. Not because how we are can be freely chosen, but because the choices that are open to us are made possible by the intersection of the immediate social settings, target of the sociologist, and the history of the present, target of the archaeologist. But the momentary sociological snapshot, which is Goffman, and the abstract historical preconditions, Michel Foucault, are essential for understanding what I call making up people. Now, to begin with Goffman, or perhaps to say with both Goffman and Foucault, yes, I am looking for some more material here. I don't quite know how it didn't come out, but anyway, it really does exist. To begin, I know where we are here, but to begin with Goffman and Foucault, it's important to remember that both of them, in their two remarkable works, Asylums and the History of Medicine, the Modern, whatever it is, and the Age of Reason, Histoire de la Folie. The title is wonderful because he's saying the history of madness in the age of reason. He's saying that the whole, it's a wonderful story of how the idea of madness was transformed in company with the way in which the idea of reason was transformed. It was not an accidental juxtaposition, but part of the essence of his story. The two people, both were enormously important for the creation of what came to be called anti-psychiatry. The name anti-psychiatry was invented by David Cooper and the sort of trio of anti-psychiatrists were R.D. Lang, Foucault, and in many ways Goffman. Foucault is sort of the Old Testament of anti-psychiatry. if you have a biblical taste, while Irving Goffman wrote the epistles. I should say just a word of a sort of personal Canadian sort about Irving Goffman, which I owe, such so we are so globalized now, to a Belgian biographer of Goffman, Winkler, who noted Goffman's father came from, escaped from the Russian army during a pogrom when they decided they didn't like any brilliant Jewish officers anymore and they would punish them, and he managed to get a boat and he ended up in a tiny village in Alberta in Canada. I mean, a really tiny village in the middle of nowhere. I've actually been there. Even when I was young, it was still nowhere. When he went there, it must have been maximally nowhere. He went to this tiny village and there met another escapee from Russia, and they produced Irving Goffman. Irving Goffman grew up, it was absolutely typical story of Canadian immigrants from Russia. Max Goffman started a little store, sold a lot of lousy bits of clothing for people who couldn't afford any more in this tiny village with 400 inhabitants. He was the store owner. He moved up to a bigger village. He finally moved to Winnipeg, which as a Canadian, tend to think of as sort of still a little bit nowhere. But one of the most interesting things about Winnipeg is that it had an extraordinary thing, which is called the North End, which even when Goffman was a boy had 17,000 Jewish inhabitants, and they had an extraordinary system of schools. I have in my own department at the University of Toronto, which is a big department but still it's not all that big, I have four people who are descended from the North End of Toronto. I go to a doctor who is descended from the North End of Toronto. My wife goes to another North End of Winnipeg. My wife goes to another doctor who is descended from the North End of Winnipeg. This was an extraordinary cultural center which produced people who have changed the world, including Irving Goffman. But what Irving—that's anecdote. But there's a little bit of Winkler's story which is extremely interesting to me. Winkler observed that in 1943, exactly when Goffman wrote exactly when Sartre wrote Being and Nothingness, Goffman, at the age of 21, had a summer job working for the National Film Board of Canada, which sounds kind of boring. National Film Board of Canada at that time produced an extraordinary number of brilliant documentaries. Somehow, the idea was Canadians don't actually know each other, so it would be important to create films in which people from one little bit of this totally spread out nonsense country get to know something about somebody else somewhere else. And they produced a series of films which have won an enormous number of international awards. In 1943, they had produced 452 films, all of which were shorts, documentaries, which were people interviewing other people in little bits of villages, towns, cities, everywhere. And what Winkler, the Belgian historian or biographer of Goffman, suggests is that he didn't learn the nature of social interactionism when he went to Chicago. He learned it from distributing, working with the people who were making these films on, you know, penny ante films, which turned out to be extraordinarily important films. I mean, I don't just mean for Canada. I mean, they were kind of National Film Board films are notoriously famous at a certain element. In any book you read on the history of documentary filming, there's always this little period of the National Film Board of Canada. That's what formed Goffman's sociology. One should not think of the kind of sociology which Goffman did, this symbolic interactionism which he learned in Chicago, as having been formed in a theoretical environment. It was rather formed by working with people who were making little underfunded documentaries of how human beings in particular locales interact with other people. I believe that that one should have as a model for understanding Goffman's work the thought of the documentary movie maker, or now television maker or whatever, who has to go in and establish some kind of relationship between the people who are there. Now, I have a lot of material here about Foucault and Goffman, which it would be inappropriate for me to read at this hour. I think the message which I would like to leave is that if one wants to pursue the Sartrean picture of a human being as someone who is created by their choices, there are two kinds of structure which one needs to impose on one's analysis, and both of them stem from the work which Foucault and Goffman began and published simultaneously in 1961. Namely, on the one hand, there is an historical story to tell. I haven't said anything about that because I've written thousands and thousands of words about it. There is an historical story to tell about how classifications come into being. They are abstract structures within which what Foucault called a discours occurs and which make possible that kind of abstract discourse. And on the other hand, there are all the face-to-face interactions which Goffman, I think, learned not from sociologists but from filmmakers of how individual people interact given the social organizations, the ways of classification that exist. If one wants to understand, there's a kind of mystery. Foucault tells us all this great story about abstract structures and there's no people there. Of course, there's some named persons, but there have to be some people in the prisons. There have to be some people in the asylums who are interacting with this stuff, this discours, which is being created around them. Goffman tells us a story of individuals in an asylum. He's there in the asylum. But he never asks, how did this way of organizing an institution come into being, and what does it represent in the larger conception of the ways in which concepts are formed within our society? So, since I see the clock is down at 6:30, I will not do this much of my talk, but will ask you in the discussion period to follow up the thought or the worries, the concerns which I have of how to bring in these two beautiful models, one might say ideal types, one of Goffman as the investigator of the relationship between individuals within social organizations, and Foucault as describing the overall structures of how those social organizations were formed with exactly those relationships. How does one study what happens in the intersection of those two? I hope I have sometimes been able to do that without any theoretical apparatus in some of the cases of making up people, which I have published. But I think there's also a need, despite my announcement earlier in this talk, that every case is on its own, there's no general theory. I think there's a need to figure out some kind of methodological approach to how to bring these two things together. It may seem that if I am using as my model stuff which was published in 1961, although of course there's an enormous tradition of extraordinary work, but it ended with the deaths of two men in 1982 and 1984, that I am talking about things that are in days gone by. It seems to me, in fact, that those two ways of approaching the existential problem which Sartre had set some 20 years earlier are the ones which are still, and only the ones which are still available to us, and we haven't figured out how to let them interact. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ian, and we now have 20 minutes or so to take up that kind offer of probing some of these issues and the relationship between the work of these two key figures for thinking about making up people in a little bit more detail by asking Ian some questions. So if you can just show your hands, and we've got some roving mics around, someone will give you a mic. I'll look to see the first question. Yes, there's one over there.
Yeah, just I was just I'm Sebastian Alma Goldsmith. I was just thinking of these the loop. Yeah, do you think there's a historic change? I'm obviously referring to the kind of from molding to modulation or something like that. Do you think there's anything like that happening?
I can stand here. I don't understand the question. Is there a change from molding to modulation? Is this some reference to something I've said, or are you referring to something? I need a mic.
I mean, you said there are these two structures that one has to take into account, yeah?
Yeah.
On the one hand, the discourse, and on the other hand, the face-to-face thing, yeah?
Yeah.
And, I mean, that sounds a bit static.
And that
A bit static.
That sounds static. Okay, I really didn't mean to have it sound static. My opening remarks about using these fancy words, dynamics and dialectics, were intended to mean we're talking about interactions. The word which I chose in the Social Construction of What book for classifications which interest me are interactive classifications. Absolutely not. I mean, look, there is one of the wonderful things about Goffman. He's talking about symbolic, I mean, he's derived from so-called symbolic interaction, the Chicago School. He's talking about what happens when people with certain kind of social frameworks and ways of classifying get to meet each other. He begins, the first thing he does, he goes to work in the Hebrides. He works in a guest house in the Hebrides. And God knows what a guest house in the Hebrides was like in that time, except that Goffman tells us. Not too different from now, as far as I can make out. I mean, there's the staff behind the, you know, and there's all these little... And he gives us the whole story of the way in which each group thinks of itself. So... just to stop talking, I'll say static, no. Goffman, absolutely no. I mean, that's notorious. What is indeed troubling about Michel Foucault is that there is a tendency when you stand back from the work to regard it as a set of rather rigorous structures which come into being and then cease to be. And part of my reason, originating with Michael Lynch, for trying to bring Goffman and Foucault, symbolically 1961, a perfect, to bring them into connection with each other, is precisely that the story of discours of Foucault, a discours which in an odd way is never spoken, a discourse which is never spoken, into connection with the language of the interaction between Goffman's study, which is displayed in Goffman's studies, where there isn't any account of how that world came to be. Stop.
There's another question there. Great jumper. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Gwetisik Thorsen. I'm at the University of Minnesota. And I wanted to ask about the, you mentioned the circle in Foucault's work, that his use of the circle as a complementary concept to Goffman's sort of feedback loop concept that he uses in Asylums. Is that one of those conceptual touching points that you see between these two books? I guess I'm unclear about exactly how they touch, how they can be brought into productive sort of methodological collaboration, given their very different approaches.
Okay, so my approach, just to be Goffman was talking about, and which is enormously important, it is the way in which, when I react to you, you react to me, and often for the thing that Goffman was drawing attention to on this particular discussion of looping, or translated as ricochet, was so I protest in the asylum or in the prison against something, I just say something very, very cautious about, I don't think it was nice for you to keep me there for an extra 10 minutes when I could have been going down to getting my crappy supper. And the guard, the warden, or whoever it is, says, uh-huh, so you're that kind, are you? And so I become really quite negative. I've got two options. I can either be totally passive, or I can then move into another mode, and I can start saying, hey, warden, you're trying to keep the food for yourself, and so on and so on. So Goffman was describing this at the level of interface between persons. The looping effect, which I talk about, is at a totally different level. Each requires, I think, the other. That is, I think when there are these personal, I'll just use the French word in English, when there are these personal ricochets back and forth, that the way in which the whole idea of the relationship between the warden and whether it's the prisoner or the mental patient gets established and changed starts to work on the whole organization of the social framework. But they're working in different levels, and they're both important. So, I mean, you know, I'm just, in all my way of thinking about these things, and just terribly eclectic. But it's also important not to make mere puns. There are different ideas which are going on. Okay?
Okay, I've got one, two, three. One here in this row. Yeah. Now, take the mic.
I just say I enjoyed your talk greatly. And my first thought was that I've been reading Bourdieu's Pascalian Meditations, and I thought Pierre Bourdieu would be terribly proud of your talk, because it's an example of a philosopher not sublimating sociological concepts but taking them extremely seriously and actually using them, which is incredibly rare. So I think Bourdieu would have been very, very pleased with that. My main point was about kind of about Sartre and kind of about this division that you overtly erect between sociology and archaeology. And I was intrigued by your invocation of Sartre. And I kept thinking about the later Foucault and his notion of practices of self and where this would come in. A much more, dare I say, sociological notion. And there's been some debate, which personally I find rather sort of circular, about whether Foucault kind of recanted his view of the subject. And I've always found that rather redundant debate. But in the light of what you were saying, it actually seemed rather interesting again. So I wondered if you had any thoughts about where you'd put that kind of third term between archaeology, sociology, and then the practices of self.
Okay, in answer to the first question, There's an obvious answer. Bourdieu voted with his feet. He was my manager in getting elected at the Collège de France.
That's one good thing for Pierre Bourdieu.
One of my managers. It's a complicated business. I am loath to use sort of general meta terms, and you did invoke a number of meta terms. I do believe that in the work of Michel Foucault, we get a development which is significantly unrelated to the level at which I want to have Goffman and Foucault employed jointly by a certain type of researcher. Foucault went on to think about the care of the self. Now, I think it's very important to realize how traditional a care this is. Foucault himself, totally out of the blue, arranged for Pierre Hadot to be his colleague. Hadot had never met him. According to Hadot, Michel Foucault phoned him up and said, "Do you want to be my colleague?" And Hadot said, "Well, I guess that might be interesting. What do I have to do?" You know, usual conversation. So Hadot, who has written entirely about the cultivation of self-awareness in spiritual exercises in ancient times, became a source for Foucault's conception of thinking about the self. Foucault gradually evolved from his archaeological through his genealogical to his, in a way, spiritual exercises — that's the phrase that Hadot uses, but it seems appropriate — concerned with the way in which a person can choose to be who they are. And there is a very curious thing which some historian of ideas will notice sometime. That is, Foucault historically grows up in a world where phenomenology, where the two heroes are Merleau-Ponty and Sartre, and of course Freud and Marx and so forth, he gives up on the idea of the subject, the self, which is at the core of Sartre's account of choice. But in his last years, in effect reworks that. But it's not just reworking Sartre, it's reworking Hadot, this is a constant thematization in Western philosophy. Or maybe we only see it as a constant thematization because of the way in which Western philosophy has evolved in the past 50 years. But we have Foucault talking about the formation of the self, which is exactly what Sartre was in his way concerned with. Foucault couldn't say, "You know, I'm really just doing Sartre all over again." He may not even have noticed he was doing Sartre all over again. But that's this kind of recycling of this idea that we're not given selves, we are selves who make ourselves. Which is also, as I said, the idea of Kant and of Aristotle. Very, very deep, and I think it would be good if you folks left thinking about the ways in which there's a kind of timelessness to what is often presented as simply trendy. That the things that come out as most powerfully trendy are, oddly enough, recapitulations of things which are timeless, which kind of worries me. We ought to be doing something new.
Okay, there's one there.
Thank you. John Clark from the Open University. I also enjoyed it enormously, especially being returned to Irving Goffman. Thank you for that.
Well, I wish I'd gone on more. I could go on for 2 hours. They're right here.
Come back. The thing that I want to ask, though, is about bringing the classification and the people who have been classified together. And it made me wonder whether you need a third poll or a third process, which is about recruitment, which is the drawing in of specific people into the classification. Because Goffman, it seems to me, is... Once you are in there, there are those dynamics and those interactions. And I suspect recruitment is, in relation to the institutions, is a bit like the College de France. It's a complicated process. And I've been desperately trying to think of another book written in 1961 that does, you know, agencies of recruitment, and I can't. I'm sorry.
Well, what about a book written yesterday? I mean, recruitment... But recruitment, yeah. Look, that's something missing. I mean, that is, of course, the absence of that is in a way made clear by the format or structure which I've just presented, Goffman and Foucault. How does anybody get there in the first place? Well, I'm not... Here I want to go back to the thing I said twice, and the second time saying I was going to repeat myself. It may not be the case that there is a general story to be told about how a particular class gets recruited. So how do anorexic teenagers get recruited to be anorexic? I mean, a very complicated story. We've got these teenagers who are, you know, and nobody has any understanding of anorexia. There are I don't want to put down individual clinicians who are extremely good at working with individual anorexic patients. But the theories which come out of the best clinicians have no generalizing power whatsoever. They just happen to be good at working. Those individuals just happen to be good at working with people. How do people get? There's no general theory of anorexia. People get recruited. Young women get recruited to be anorexics, and people tell all this stuff. Well, you know, we've got all these Twiggies in, or whoever it happens to be, who are on the stage on. Who are in advertisements, you're told all this stuff, but there's no explanation of how you get recruited at all. But I suspect that we're not going to get an interesting story about recruitment to anorexia which maps onto recruitment to some other category. Of course, in the case of Goffman, the people got recruited, in the case of Goffman's earlier studies, people got recruited because they were turned in by their relatives to the asylums, or they checked themselves in themselves, or because they were prisoners. And in general, when Goffman began, his total institutions, the totalizing institutions, his examples were almost all ones in which people had no choice about recruitment. The boarding school, the one case which has always interested me, which is a total institution, is the ship. Whether you take the voyages of the heroic period, where people somehow ended up in ships, which were total institutions in Goffman's sense, for months and months and months and months, or whether you take a current naval personnel who sign up for a nuclear submarine and who are going to be in this absolutely total institution. There's no way of getting out for sometimes when they're going through the Arctic or the whatever, patrolling, whatever they think they're patrolling, for like 4 months. They're underwater. They're just there, those people and all the rules of the... But those people are interesting because they, in some sense, chose to do it. Whereas the people who are in boarding schools, in general, didn't choose to be there. They may be very pleased to be there, or they may hate being there, but they were sent there by their parents. The people who end up in prisons may, in some secondary sense, have chosen to be there, but in a primary sense, they didn't actually volunteer, with one or two exceptions, didn't actually volunteer to go to prison, and so on. So the question of recruitment is important, and we should have a next question.
Okay, we're going to take two more questions in the pink there, back, and then Mary. I've been unjust. Let's see how we go, but we're getting on to our time. Sorry.
Hello. Hi. I'm here. Janet Lowe from Imperial College. I just wanted to take seriously the question that you ended your talk with when you said, where shall I go to look? Between Foucault, who looks up to the where the words come from to hit us from the great sky of unknown, to Goffman, who looks to his neighbour, the little guy next to him. And I wanted to suggest that you could do a lot worse than going to read Lacan.
Oh, where could I go worse? I'm sorry for making a bad pun. I personally give this as a recommendation to the people here. I cannot support it because I'm ignorant, because somehow that, although there are kind of flashes which I pick up when I read some of the seminars, which seem to be the best. I don't know if you agree with that. Sorry, I'll talk here. Even when I read what I personally take to be the best, namely the seminars of Lacan, the real lot, again, interactions with people, and himself doing his number, I do not see any way of helping me with my understanding of making up people. But undoubtedly, there's a whole other range, and all I can say is direct your remark to people here. I'm probably just too old, really, to take up on Lacan, whereas you, I mean, a lot of folks here who are not too old to take up on Lacan. So that's the way to go. But I would like to know, not in the course of this discussion, but maybe afterwards, how one uses Lacan in the way which you say. There should be another questioner, I think.
Yeah. One question, and then I'm going to take one from upstairs, but Mary first.
Mary.
Hello. This has been a fabulous, introspective kind of evening, and I think the kind of question I want to ask you, you know already what I want to ask you, is out of order, but I ask it in three forms. One is, you profess to be baffled and looking for a solution to a way of analyzing the relation. I don't think you like the word analyzing. A way of relating Foucault's insights and the gap between that, which is very general and institutional, really, and Goffman's, which is personal and intimate and empirical. And I get the feeling that you don't want, that you want to work at a very low level of generalization, in which case I am ruled out because I'm an anthropologist. And I can't quite understand why you want us to talk about this without taking into account possible ways of bundling together some of the ideas you're using. Like, here it is, always about the self and the person, and these unnamed other persons who are putting these labels out. And you've got an interactive system between the person and the labels, such that the persons are coming up in response to labels, but they're the same persons are also presumably doing some labeling as well. But if it's just a system that you're talking about, a loop, if it's going round, not only are there good mathematical descriptions that you could be using which would be general enough and relate them all together, but it would force you to look at other aspects of this labeling process. A person, response. And then after a bit, this particular kind of response goes out of fashion. It's a transient phenomenon, a transient illness. But that would surely be because the first set, one would suppose that the illness to some degree is randomly distributed, and then for some, in some niches of society, it becomes very prone, and it gets a label, and then it goes on under the label. But then surely the word we're not using, which is the culture of other people's judgments and classifications, is saying, is talking about it too much, and it becomes something that the person who is getting these diseases becomes very aware of, and so they begin to criticize themselves. So you need the whole interaction, both for the labeling side and for the relating of the two parts of the general theorem, I think.
Right. May I acknowledge, literally for the first time, when I started using the word loop. It was after I had read Mary Douglas's book, How Institutions Think. Now, of course, loop is a very general word. I mean, looping effect has been there forever. But as a matter of fact, a matter of boring historical fact, if there's some boring historical noter here, I actually picked it up from Mary Douglas's book. Although, of course, I put it to uses totally unintended by her and for which she has contempt, probably. Look, Mary, I think that you're just, that in an odd way, you're repeating my lesson of Foucault and Goffman. You're saying that you're not attending closely enough to the way in which classifications get constituted within a larger historical framework. I don't want to say culture, I want to say historical. And then become deployed as if they had no history by the sorts of institutions and actors whom Goffman describes. So it seems to me that here there's just a... My way of looking at things and the way that you have just presented are much closer than you seem to be suggesting. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just simply missing something in what you've just said. But they seem to me, seems to me that what I was going for here with this reaction to Michael Lynch about why don't you talk about Goffman, is precisely what you're encouraging at the moment in your comments.
I'm sure I'm getting
to like the finish. Have you got energy for two more?
Yeah, I can do 67.
All right, because I've been accused of being unjust and neglecting the upstairs, I'm going to take two questions from upstairs, and then I think we really do have to call it a day. So there was one hand over here. Yep. Oh, behind you, yep. And then one over there in the blue.
Sorry, Gary Littlejohn, formerly Bradford University. A couple of comments and a quick question. The first comment is about a book called 7 Military Classics of Ancient China. I think that's an interesting book on the concept of recruitment. The text is about 2,200 years old, and it's about recruiting different kinds of warriors by Chinese generals, but I think it's very similar to the kind of stuff you're saying implicitly. So you're right, there really is nothing new under the sun. Second comments on concentration camps. I think they're a different kind of total institution from the kind of earlier colonial total institutions like the Devil's Island in the Caribbean or the Andaman Islands under Indian colonial rule. Because they are industrial complexes, you might say. For example, the Springfield rifle was the kind of first industrial mass-produced product, and the first concentration camp was actually introduced by the Americans in Havana in 1899, then copied by the British in 1901, and then the Heinrich Goering, Hermann's father, in 1908 in German Southwest Africa. So that's then into, of course, Germany itself. That's a kind of new industrial sort of total institution, which is quite different from a Foucauldian or a Goffman one, I think. I forgot my question, so I'll just give up now.
Ian, don't answer that. I'm going to take one more comment from Stephen over there, and then you can say your last words, and then we're going to have to stop, I'm afraid.
My question's very short. When you started to relate Goffman and Foucault, you said you weren't going to talk about power effects, and I just want to know why.
Closing words.
Because they have been over-talked about, and anything I would say which had a relevance to power effects would be so obvious it wouldn't be worth mentioning.
Okay, then I have to come back. Do you not think, when you're trying to think about this question of how to relate the Goffman level to the Foucault level, the concept of power has some role to play?
Of course, of course, that's why I don't want to talk about it, because it's so obvious. I mean, Goffman, there's a sentence which is written down somewhere in front of me here, where Goffman says, these are the institutions which, in the most clear form, we use in order to declare the character of individuals. He says, the institutions are the devices by which we form individuals. And if the word power effect had come into usage then, he would probably not have used it, because he'd never used words which were familiar. He always wanted to use his own terminology, which was always wiser than using what was the jargon of the day. But he could have perfectly well said, you know, I'm studying power effects. Of course, in both these people, beginning with the same, as Goffman called it, total institution, the asylum, are studying the effects of power. But that's, I mean, look, Foucault's marvelous on power. He says, first of all, and maybe many readers of Foucault don't altogether notice this, I think most do, power is not to be thought of as something which comes from above. Power is something that we all participate in. He never gave the sociological dynamics of how we participate in the power. That's what Goffman was doing. Foucault's wonderful remarks about the subject, the constitution of the subject, which is, of course, a radically anti-Sartrean remark in its time, that the old picture was that the subject was constituted by the sovereign, reference to Hobbes, Leviathan. But Hobbes said, we, the subjects, have to constitute Leviathan, who will keep us sensible. And Foucault said, no, that very Leviathan is constituted by the way in which each of us, in a Sartrean way, which he would not like to have said, makes our own choices. He talked a little bit about rivulets up and down, but really, in a sense, you could say that what Foucault was going against was the picture of power exercised from above, but rather of an absolutely, in a sense, egalitarian construction of power in which we all participate by our own choices. And very odd. It's very odd to talk about Michel Foucault as being someone who is working out some of the consequences of Sartre. And of course, there were terrible. There's a horrible interview, in which Foucault is talking off the record, which got published, and which he got very angry about, because he said these were just casual remarks. But in an odd way, when he came back, when he saw the thing published and wrote a long letter to the editor, said, you know, many of my ideas are really profoundly influenced by Sartre. They are the ways in which we make the choices. I just want to do it without the notion of this kind of Freudianly impossible choosing subject. But I'm going to talk about how power relations are constituted in the course of all of us choosing how we are to be. So the reason I don't want to talk about power relations is that they're everywhere, and so why should one talk about space?
All right, well, I must apologize to those of you who I know are itching to ask questions, but we're well past our time. So I'd like to thank Ian very much for a terrific lecture and a very And just for those of you, I'm afraid it's by invitation only to the reception, which is on the fifth floor in the senior common room. So someone will usher you up the inadequate lifts to find that.